Morning, Your Honor. Kevin Burns for Mr. Armstrong. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case presents an interesting issue under the Privacy Act as to what extent the Privacy Act protects against disclosures. In this particular case, the government has offered two theories as a defense which are contradictory and inconsistent. The facts of this case showed, and they've been briefed fairly extensively, that what happened here was that information regarding Mr. Armstrong was given to a potential employer through six letters that were drafted. Those letters led to a trial, and during the course of the trial, the issue that came up before the court is, was the information in the letters so extensive and significant that in and of itself it must have been gained through a system of records from somebody either observing criminal and administrative investigations of Mr. Armstrong or somebody who talked to individuals who did have access to those administrative and criminal investigations who actually produced those reports.
What is one datum that could not have derived from Mr. Armstrong himself?
He
spoke with his colleagues, he spoke with others, he acknowledged that.
No, he acknowledged that colleagues came and discussed the matter with him. See, he never testified.
Well, did he stand there mute?
But that would turn the act on its head, because what happened is that he was confronted with individuals, came up and said, I heard you're under investigation. Now, at no time did Mr. Armstrong tell any individual, have any discussion with any individual, about the actual facts of the investigation, about him admitting to any facts of the investigation.
Does he say, I didn't do that?
Does he say?
Is there in the record his saying, I never told anyone that I admitted anything?
Well, there is nothing in the record that says he told anyone he did.
I understand that, but he says he discussed his case with various of his colleagues and former coworkers.
Right, but that was a question that was left unresolved by the court. The court surmised that because he was confronted with information and engaged in a responsive discussion, that meant he disclosed the integral facts of his criminal and administrative investigation.
There are two possibilities, at least. One is that the author of these letters, what is her name?
Thompson.
Ms. Thompson. Got illicit access, unlawful access to the file. The other is that the information came out from somebody who had lawful access and could lawfully repeat it, and that would be Mr. Armstrong.
But Mr. Armstrong.
And I don't know how we can negate his being the source of this, what became common knowledge in the office.
Because there was no evidence that he was the source. He never discussed.
That she is the source. Or that she went to the record, but if you can negate
this, there's evidence that he did discuss this.
I think that the court is accepting a premise that wasn't actually established.
I'm just accepting the transcript of the testimony of Mr. Armstrong.
But Mr. Armstrong never got to a trial phase where he could discuss in detail what information he disclosed or did not disclose.
I'm sorry, was he cut off in the middle of
the trial was truncated?
Pardon?
Counsel was about to bring out the content of these conversations, which he acknowledged, and was cut off?
No, what happened is that in a deposition, the government obliquely asked him certain questions about whether he had had conversations regarding matters in the office. It never went into any specific inquiry as to what those matters were.
He has the burden in this case.
Well, he does, Your Honor, but let me suggest that the analysis of our case can be best looked at by looking at two exhibits in the record that I think address your point. There is no evidence in this record anywhere that Mr. Armstrong discussed with anyone that he admitted any misconduct. The only one he had that discussion with in the record is with the agents themselves.
Correct me if I'm wrong.
Sure.
There's testimony by him that he discussed the matter with people. But there isn't any detail as to what he said, right? Either affirmatively or negatively.
When he went and spoke to investigators.
I'm not talking about those conversations.
The testimony in the record says that until he was actually confronted, he never discussed this matter with anyone. And in the record, it says that he never talked about any of the details of the investigations themselves. He just had discussions with people that he was under investigation. And he didn't even know until he was told by others in the agency, not the agents themselves, but by somebody else, what the nature of the investigation was. That's what's in the transcript. But I think that the court can look at two exhibits in this case, which are plaintiffs PA-20 and PA-69.
Where are they?
They are in our appendix, Your Honor. Appendix of Mr. Armstrong, the original. And then the second is in the appendix. They're both in the appendix, Your Honor. One is at
20, okay.
20 and 69.
All right.
Ms. Thompson says in her initial complaint, she says, very specific, that what she's complaining about is my client's access to the Paris database. She says right in the first paragraph that...
I'm sorry, what page are we?
PA-20. PA's 20 and 69, Your Honor.
Okay.
In her initial complaint to the agency, she says... that her concern is that he accessed the Paris database. That's what she says, one database. Mr. Armstrong never had a discussion with any employee other than when the investigative agents about access to ChoicePoint, which is a separate database. In her complaint to the Department of Agriculture when she sent the letters, she says he accessed multiple databases.
Where are you?
Various databases on PA-20, Your Honor.
Where on that page?
It is... It says, if you look at the second paragraph, various databases. The only information that he accessed more than one database was given to investigators. It was never disclosed to any employee. It was never discussed with any employee. It couldn't have been known by any employee except for the investigators in the case. Because the ChoicePoint allegation didn't come up until investigators themselves accessed his database entries and discovered that he had a separate database that he was using. So she could simply not have known that fact, nor could she have known that he made admissions to any party. There is nothing in the record, no one ever asked him, and he has never stated that he admitted to anyone any wrongdoing in this case or made admissions to any individual. The only...
At the supplemental appendix at A9, he's asked, once you learned of the specifics of the investigation, did you then speak to persons outside of the TIGTA agency?
Yes.
Yes, Joanne Jensen, a former ASAC at TIGTA. Anyone else? Bill Sterling, who was with TIG. What's TIG? Treasury IG. Who'd you tell that you applied for the job? This is another part of this, right? And he says, maybe John Phillips, I don't recall. Joanne Jensen? Yes. Bill Sterling, at some point I know we discussed it. So he's talking about this with various people, and if there's some specific aspect of it that he doesn't tell anybody, I don't see it anywhere in the transcript.
But then what happens is that what he was asked is, did you talk about the investigation? He said yes. That doesn't mean he talked about the criminal investigation. It doesn't mean he talked about the admissions. It doesn't mean he talked about the details. And it certainly...
That's okay. Where did you meet your burden on this?
I think we established our burden on this, Your Honor, by showing a couple of things. First of all, that Ms. Thompson authored a letter, a record for the government, that she sent to trigger an investigation. And she then disclosed what she says on her own, not her opinions, but she disclosed the contents of that. And she disclosed that
Her own letter?
Of her own letter. But the interesting thing
This is a different point than the one we've been discussing, correct?
Well, it is. But I think the interesting point on the burden is, where in any of this does Mr. Armstrong know what his proposed penalty is before the agency imposes it? Where could he even know that?
It's your burden. I don't know.
But that we met that burden. We said in the trial court, we said, this information that she disclosed in her letter, that he was being proposed for termination, she said it before the proposal was issued. Okay? She had the prognostication powers of Nostradamus in this case.
If she had the knowledge of what the charges were or what the nature of the complaint against him was, because she made the complaint.
Right.
Wouldn't it be common knowledge that that's a dischargeable offense?
No, because the agency had kept him in a position for almost a year from that charge, and taken no action, and she would have had no knowledge of the personnel action itself. That's what the agency says. I see my time is up, Your Honor. My problem is, if we accept the agency's actual premise that they held this information tightly, how did anyone even know he was under investigation to begin with? And how did anyone know the details of that
investigation? She knew because she initiated it.
Right, but she and
other people saw him being escorted from the building. Someone saw him, his car was parked there, he didn't have use of it.
But nobody
knew. He wasn't coming into the office.
Nobody knew he was under criminal investigation except for the investigators. She says he committed criminal misconduct. Nobody knew that fact except for the investigators. Nobody knew the fact about his reassignment per se. Nobody knew the fact that he had been stripped of his supervisory duties. They don't know. They just know he went somewhere else. Nobody knew
it
that
was when he was marched out of the building?
Well, he was taken out of the building and then brought somewhere. He was detailed to another assignment. People knew that. They didn't know he was stripped of administrative duties.
It wasn't an assignment that was common knowledge that people were put there when they were under investigation.
Well, but the trouble is that there was no common knowledge. I guess my problem is that assuming everything that the government says and the court says is true, who had the common knowledge that he was under a criminal investigation and then that he was being proposed for a disciplinary action which was for termination before the action had even been proposed? I mean, I think it is somewhat fantastical that she gets all these facts right, okay, and surmises that somehow the adversary who in the office, who she despised, was the source of the information. She didn't gather this information. She never says she gathered the information from Mr. Armstrong, nor does she say she gathered it from any specific employee. She says she
used the term water cooler gossip, right? As I recall.
But wouldn't that then become a shield for any Privacy Act claim? And isn't that the legislative history of the Act?
Well, not for a lot of. Not for a lot. Things like physical handing of the record, obviously not.
But this court has never held it.
No. I understand that that's not the only thing that satisfies.
If I may, Your Honor, the it says that the protective purposes of the Act were to require employees to reclaim from disclosing records or personnel data in them within the agency, and this section is designed to prevent the office gossip, interoffice, and interbureau leaks of information about persons of interest in the agency or community, or such actions as the publicizing of information of a sensational or salacious nature. This is a law enforcement agency. What can be more core to its mission than the protection and sanctity and limitation of the disclosure of ongoing criminal administrative investigations?
Then isn't it reasonable for her to infer that if he's accused of violating that sort of a norm, that it's going to be a criminal investigation? That doesn't seem surprising.
But how would she know what the results of the investigation were? How would she know what the proposed penalty was going to be? How would she know that he made actual admissions? How would she know that he admitted to anything? I mean, when she was testifying under court, and remember, she disclosed this on the eve of trial, so we didn't even have the chance to depose her in advance. And this trial was stopped after 2 days. We didn't even get a chance to finish the trial. How is it that she knows all of this information?
After 2 days, you mean for 3 months?
Well, right, but the
so that you could gather information to make your case, which is came back and resume trial.
But the problem was the information we were allowed to gather was to access to get access to the agency's Paris database to show whether she accessed it or not. But the records were kept outside Paris, and the government said, well, we kept the records outside Paris so that nobody could get access to them. So we were left to chase around a negative when the evidence, I think, that the evidence is rather overwhelming that either she has tremendous ability to put together maybe one or two facts I could agree with the court, but she puts together his entire history. She puts together steps that have been taken against him that nobody else knows about him, admissions he made. She puts together a criminal investigation that the agency says it didn't even tell anybody he was under except for the five people. It is one thing to say...
Five people?
Right.
Other than she knew about this?
The five supervisors knew about the criminal investigation, and they kept it tightly held. The trouble is that the agency said we took all these steps to preserve the information, and somehow she gets it and discloses it, and it's information well beyond what she put in her original complaint. If the court does not accept the premise that her disclosure of her own record is a Privacy Act violation, it certainly has the second set of records that she disclosed in the letters. And then it has on top of that Mr. Delgado's disclosures, which were direct. And again, we have witnesses who the court found were dissembling and incredible. And we have a senior official who contradicts another senior official from the USDA who has no motive. And the court come back to us and says, you have not met your burden of proof, even though you've established that all these witnesses seem not to be telling the truth. And the court comes in and cements that by saying, and I believe this might be the result of an inadvertent leak or a source other than someone else.
He said she was an evasive witness, and she was clearly a difficult witness.
Dissembling, I think he said.
Did he say?
Yes.
Dissembling. As I read her testimony, as a law enforcement officer, she simply wasn't going to say anything that was unless the question was precise. And so that made her a difficult witness. But when the questions were made precise, she answered them, and then in several instances said, I didn't know, I was inferring or I was guessing.
But then doesn't that undercut what the court is saying about an office rumor mill? Because she doesn't say that I got all these surmises from an office rumor mill. She says, I surmised them on my own.
Some, she says, were common knowledge, were being discussed in the office.
Whether Mr. Armstrong was escorted out of the building is not the central point to the violation. The central point is that she sent a letter as a law enforcement agent to a law enforcement agency to deprive him permanently of employment that disclosed a criminal and administrative investigation that was in a system of records supposedly guarded by the agency that she simply shouldn't have known about and couldn't have known about unless she either saw the records herself or discussed them with somebody who had the records. And I think it stretches credulity to argue that somehow Mr. Armstrong came in and disclosed all this information by merely talking to people and acknowledging that he was under investigation. And it stretches credulity to say that somehow she could put all this together based on water cooler talk when she herself says, I didn't get it from the water cooler. I thought it up in my head. I surmised
that
it.
Only first to her own direct information, her own, to some extent, conversations with other people, and to some extent, surmise. I don't think she ever breaks things down as to what's what.
But how can it be that an agency comes and says, we have a criminal administrative investigation, which is what we do. We're a law enforcement agency, and we guard that. And somebody finds out about them and discloses them in great detail. And the only thing, in the defense they come in, again, this is on the eve of trial when the court, we were probably better off with the court saying we had no witness to say who disclosed it because the court was leaning towards res ipsa. She comes in and says, I intentionally and maliciously did this. I did this on purpose. I did this to harm Harry Armstrong. And we ask her the penultimate question. She's represented by counsel. She's met with the agency. We ask her the question is, did you get this from a system of records? We have a dissembling witness who's evasive, and she says no and lets the agency off the hook, when the overwhelming evidence suggests that we have met our burden. I mean, I think that the court would be imposing a burden that is too great for any plaintiff unless someone actually comes out and simply says, I got this from a system of records, now subject me to civil and criminal liability. I think that that is unrealistic, and I do think that this case follows more in line with Bartel and Doe and those other cases that expand the act to include those circumstances where somebody is disclosing information that they gleaned from a record or from a speaker with access to those records. This is narrow, and my time is up.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Burns.
May it please the court, I'm Andrea Tebbutt, and with me at the council table is Stephen Uecchio, co-counsel for the government. As a threshold issue, it is not clear exactly what record Mr. Armstrong is saying has been disclosed. The basis of the claims appears to be that Karen Thompson's initial complaint to TIGTA, alleging unauthorized access and disclosures by Mr. Armstrong, was a protected agency record that triggered an investigation, which she then disclosed in the six letters to the Department of Agriculture. But her initial complaint to TIGTA was not maintained by the agency as the statute requires. It was created on her home computer. and it was unknown to the agency apparently for nearly 2 years between the time this investigation began and the time of her deposition. Nor was it contained within a system of records. Mr. Armstrong has suggested that somehow the mere receipt of this record by TIGTA would convert it into a record within a system of records.
What do you mean? But it was unknown to the agency for 2 years if she sent them the letter.
Her role in creating it.
Because they were anonymous letters.
Yes, because it was anonymous. I should clarify that. The fact that she created it on her home computer was unknown to the agency. We have no evidence in the record as to the location and handling of this document once it was received. And the district court's opinion in Krieger makes clear that to have a record within a system of records, you need a group of records under agency control from which information is actually retrieved. This hasn't been shown in this case.
What about the question of a proposed penalty?
Excuse me?
The proposed penalty, that would seem to be Armstrong's strongest point. That what was being proposed, he says, was then disclosed before action was taken on it.
What we have here is we do, in fact, have a lot of evidence, more evidence than Mr. Armstrong's counsel has suggested, that Mr. Armstrong himself was speaking openly. We know, I think, from common sense that people talk in offices. Word gets around. Things are seen. People will talk. We also have...
The weakest thing to fit into that is yes. The proposed penalties.
But we also have Karen Thompson's testimony that she, is, as an experienced law enforcement official, could pretty much figure out what might be going on. And to get back, though, to the burden of proof, to some extent, Mr. Armstrong's argument boils down to the notion that in the absence of evidence, he should prevail. That upends the burden of proof. Mr. Armstrong himself said in his motion for judgment in this case that it remains a mystery where Karen Thompson got her information. Mr. Armstrong has said in his reply brief that there is no explanation for how she got the information. In those circumstances, he...
Well, I mean, that takes us back to the res ipsa theory, right? And at least the greatest single weakness in the res ipsa theory is that Armstrong himself is a potential source of huge amounts of information. But the one point as to which that seems to break down, and you answer it in terms of her surmise, is the proposal of a particular penalty, right?
Yes, but again, that could be surmise, that could easily be surmise. What we have here is...
Do we have any data in the record as to the frequency with which that penalty was administered for this class of offenses?
I don't believe that is in the record. I do not believe that's in the record. But the other problem here is Mr. Armstrong is trying to suggest that somehow the letters to the Department of Agriculture tracked exactly investigative records. He has said that the sole identified source of her information was investigative records. The only investigative record we have in the record here is the record of investigation, or report of investigation, beginning on page 63 of the plaintiff's appendix. There is a great deal of information in the letters to the Department of Agriculture that doesn't come from that report, and we have no other investigative records in the record of this case. We simply don't know where Ms. Thompson got her information. But it's not the government's burden to prove or disprove where she got her information. It is Mr. Armstrong's burden of proof. And in fact, some of this, I think the court recognizes the evidence that we do have suggests that a lot of this information was commonly held. Now, all the district court needed, all that we need to prevail in this case, in fact, is a plausible view of the evidence found by the district court. And that's what we have. The district court, it's true, said that Ms. Thompson was evasive in some respects, but perhaps dissembling. Her testimony covered a lot of ground, and it is not at all clear which of the evidence the district court chose to believe or disbelieve, except to the extent that the district court says in its opinion, most likely Ms. Thompson did not get her information from a protected source. So he did believe her to that extent when she said that she didn't. And that is a plausible view of the evidence. And the fact that Mr. Armstrong is able to come up with an alternate view of the evidence does not obviously mean that the district court's factual findings can be set aside. Now, Mr. Armstrong tries to bring this case within the scope of Bartell, but—
Can I ask you a question? When she wrote the letter that said that she believed that termination was being considered, was that factually accurate at the time? Do we know?
I believe it was not factually accurate, and that's another point, Your Honor, that I wanted to make, that there are points in the agriculture letters that were incorrect, and Mr. Armstrong's counsel went to great lengths
At the time she wrote that letter, was there anything that we now have in the record that shows that it was in writing at the time that shows that that was termination was being considered?
Or not, yeah.
Anything about termination?
I'm afraid I cannot answer that offhand.
If there was not, then that helps.
I'm sorry.
If there was not, then we're in the realm of surmise more. If there was, then that's a problem in terms of plausibility.
At the point she wrote those letters, if I may just refer to the report of the investigation. The report of the investigation, results of the investigation, report of the investigation. Suggests that prosecution has, the referral memorandum suggests that indicates that prosecution has been declined, and I'm afraid I don't know offhand if at that point there was firm evidence that termination had been considered and declined. But to return to Bartell, and its procedural posture, this case is different, because in Bartell, the plaintiff was appealing the dismissal of a complaint before any discovery. Here, Mr. Armstrong has challenged a judgment on the merits made on factual findings after extensive discovery, including a suspension of the trial to allow him to take more discovery. In Bartell, the court found a genuine issue of material fact whether an agency official had read a record of investigation. Here, the district court found that Mr. Armstrong failed to prove that the information came from a protective record. Beyond that, however, this court in Bartell emphasized the disclosing official's record-related role, that it was only because of his record-related role that he had acquired the information in the first place and was able to disclose the determination, an official determination that he made. Ms. Thompson had no record-related role. She was Armstrong's subordinate, not his chief. She did not order or request the investigation. She did not make an official determination based on an investigation. She made allegations based on her own initial complaint, something that, as I said, was not an agency record. She supplemented those by observation, surmise, and general office knowledge. Mr. Armstrong's suggestion in his reply brief, if I may just continue my thought, that that Ms. Thompson's mere suspicion does not rise to the level of independent knowledge is not a meaningful distinction under Bartell. And if anything, it takes this case farther from Bartell by underscoring that we did not have a proven disclosure of an agency record. His suggestion that she transformed her suspicions into something official by sending them to TIGTA is really the reverse of Bartell, where the report of the official report and determination grew out of the investigation, and it's baseless to the extent that much of what she said in her letters was wrong. Finally, his characterization of Ms. Thompson as a supervising agent is misleading. She was not supervising him. And the assertion in the reply brief, which has been repeated here, that the agency should be liable for these kinds of poison pen letters, because otherwise there will be no incentive to curtail such behavior, and indeed an incentive for subordinates to smear at their superiors, is surely disrespectful to the federal workforce, ignores the power of considerations of the public trust and good government, which create obvious incentives in the right directions.
Are you quoting something?
No.
You're just reading.
I'm sorry. I'm
okay.
Yeah.
All right. I think you're well past time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Take a minute, please, Mr. Burns.
Very briefly, Your Honor. There's a little bit of confusion here. The anonymous complaint went into a system of records. It went into the complaints file records, which then triggered the criminal investigation in the first instance. So it was within a system of records. It wasn't something that she just created out of thin air. She is a trained.
So she created it out of thin air first, and then it became part of a record, right?
Well, she created a complaint with the hopes of triggering the investigation. And she knew enough about the agency to know that it would create an official record and therefore create an issue for Armstrong. The other thing is, and I think as the court pointed out, the more significant factor is the idea that I think the proposed termination, again, she surmised that before it was even proposed. Now, there is a week's time period between when she discloses and when they took it. I don't know the agency's procedures.
When they took what?
When they took the action to propose, and I don't know whether. Now, I'll just finish quickly. The court asked about discovery. One of the issues we raised is.
Where was that? Where's a record of that? You're saying that so when she wrote the letter to USDA, they had not yet discussed proposed termination?
We don't know because our motion to compel discovery on those sorts of issues was never ruled on, so we were never able. I think that the remedy that the court could impose if it has concerns is to remand this action for a more developed record on some of the issues that it's raised, and so obviously they go to the core of the case. And I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Byrne. Mr. Tebbets, thank you. The case is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.